KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. It's time to mask up again in New Mexico, regardless of your vaccination status. A face covering is required for everyone indoors. In depth, here's Madison Staton.
Following a rise in COVID-19 hospitalizations, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has implemented an indoor mask mandate. The mandate is expected to last through at least September 15th.
We now are reinstating an indoor mask requirement for any indoor activity. Outdoors, not required. It doesn't matter indoors whether you're vaccinated or not. It's a universal policy.
Statewide, COVID-19 hospitalizations have risen significantly over the last few weeks, jumping from 180 on August 3rd to over 340 on August 17th. Acting Health Secretary Dr. David Scrace says that a large portion of hospitalizations have occurred within the unvaccinated population, stressing that hospitalizations are 25 times more likely among the unvaccinated.
We see higher case counts. It's just more common for people that people in their own family who have COVID, and people start to get more careful. So part of that flattening of the curve is the public reaction to all of this. But I am just very, very concerned about what's going to happen in hospitals in the next 3 to 4 weeks. And so are all the people who run them.
He says current modeling suggests all New Mexicans, even those that are vaccinated, should wear masks to help mitigate the spread of COVID-19, specifically highlighting schools.
The model where vaccinated people don't have to wear masks actually produces 400 more cases a day throughout all of New Mexico, not just in schools, all through New Mexico, than if we let the kids who've been vaccinated not wear masks.
The state also introduced vaccination requirements for hospital workers and those in congregate care settings like nursing homes. Unvaccinated employees have a 10-day window to get their first COVID-19 shot. The New Mexico Department of Health estimates that over 27,000 New Mexico healthcare workers still need to be vaccinated. Governor Lujan Grisham says that while she's aware mandatory vaccination requirements can lead to employee pushback, the state must do all it can to ensure a safe healthcare environment.
Across the country, and including in New Mexico, you know, the escalation of anger among employees about what's occurring, and we need to de-escalate that. This has become, and it shouldn't have ever, very still way too political without facts and science being available to even healthcare workers.
She says her top priority is protecting both healthcare personnel and New Mexico residents.
Make no mistake, we're in a terrible place for healthcare services and for protecting our healthcare workers. And too many New Mexicans, again, are going to lose their lives or have long-term chronic illnesses because of the rate of spread of COVID.
The governor says that further restrictions, such as capacity requirements and travel constraints, are not expected at this time. Her goal is that an increase in vaccinations and mask wearing will allow COVID cases to decline by winter.
We're going to continue to climb, and that these issues are going to be exacerbated, which is why we're making tough but necessary decisions right now. My hope is that New Mexico can be the most vaccinated place on earth, and we eradicate to the highest degree that you can. I don't foresee that we have to utilize other tools.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staton.
Classes resumed this week at New Mexico State University for the fall semester, and officials say they are ready even as COVID cases continue to surge. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports.
NMSU Vice Chancellor and Chief COVID-19 Officer Ruth Johnston says they've tightened protocols, meaning students and system employees at all five campuses will need to provide proof of vaccination or proof of a negative COVID-19 test on a weekly basis beginning September 30th.
And the reason for that was not because we wanted to delay things or make our community less safe. In fact, we wanted to give people the opportunity to be able to get the vaccine if they hadn't already.
The University of New Mexico and Central New Mexico Community Colleges have both issued similar policies based on guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Free vaccination clinics and testing sites are planned for the main and branch campuses. Johnston says now that the Delta variant is spreading, both faculty and students must mask up.
We have to wear masks indoors at all times, all of us, vaccinated or unvaccinated. So we're making deliberate, intentional decisions for the greater good of the community to try to be as safe as we possibly can be.
This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Stay with KRWG News and NPR for the latest on the coronavirus crisis. You'll find links at the top of the region's homepage, krwg.org, for the latest information, as well as links for COVID testing and vaccination. At least 19 people have died in tribal jails overseen by the federal government since 2016, according to an investigation by NPR and the Mountain West News Bureau. As part of our ongoing coverage of mistreatment of inmates on reservations, we're highlighting some of the victims and the circumstances around their deaths, which reflect decades of mismanagement, neglect, and poor training. Here's the Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie.
It was a typically hot, muggy June day in Washington, D.C. when Inspector General Earl Devaney sat down in front of senators.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It was 2004. The Iraq War was raging. President Bush was in a heated battle for re-election. But on this day, the senators were about to hear troubling testimony about the more than 70 detention centers overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
BIA's detention program is riddled with problems, and in our opinion, is a national disgrace, with many facilities having conditions comparable to those found in third world countries.
An investigation by Devaney's office found more than 800 serious incidents at these jails. They included deaths, attempted suicides, and escapes. One man was found hanging in his cell after being left unmonitored for 2 hours. And on the Yakima Reservation in Washington State, they found a woman who was confined in a windowless cell. She hadn't seen daylight for nearly 2 weeks. Devaney said the conditions were a violation of basic civil rights.
Nothing, however, less than a Herculean effort to turn these conditions around would be morally acceptable.
Senators introduced legislation that would reform the BIA corrections program, but it failed to pass. Meanwhile, the agency promised change. Over the next 2 decades, it introduced a new policy handbook, bolstered training, and rebuilt about a third of its jails. Congress gave the detention center program a slight boost in funding, but it was nowhere near the estimated $135 million the agency says it needs. And today, the death toll remains the same.
There's basically really hasn't been any kind of major improvement.
Ed Naranjo is a former BIA official and whistleblower who helped spur the 2004 investigation. He isn't surprised the BIA failed to complete its overhaul of the detention center program.
There's not enough resources and people to address those issues. And so as a result, you know, nothing's done.
That inaction cost a 22-year-old grocery store worker named Willie Pepian his life. I meet his mom, Wilma Fleury, at her home on the Blackfeet Reservation in north central Montana. Pepian's dog, Shooter, greets me. He's a pit bull mix.
Hey, Shooter, how are you?
It's been more than a year since Pepian died at the BIA-operated jail on the reservation. His mom has taken down all of his pictures. They're tucked away in a closet because seeing them is too painful.
My one friend told me, she goes, some days, Wilma, you feel like you're going crazy. So when I start feeling like that, I usually go outside or I take a long walk, be by myself. But then I get really angry.
She's angry because of how her son died. Pepian was at a house when a fight broke out and someone hit him in the head with a shovel. When police arrived, they arrested him. He was taken to a hospital where doctors cleared him to spend the day in jail. But they missed a serious injury. The shovel had cracked his skull. No one from the hospital would comment. When police took him to the jail, he had dried blood on his face. Frederick Noon Jr. says he was in jail with Pepian that day.
He asked that jailer, I need help.
Noon says he tried to get the guard's attention on Pepian's behalf.
I was like, hey, this guy needs help. He's pretty sick. Then she was like, no, lay down, go pass out.
Federal policy says guards are supposed to take someone to a health clinic if they ask for help like this, but records show correctional officers never brought Pepian back to the hospital. Noon says for the next few hours, Pepian was in pain.
He wouldn't let his head touch his pillow. It's like he's protecting his head. He looked like a little baby, you know, falling asleep and his bobbing his head up and down, moaning and groaning.
Federal policy requires guards to personally check on inmates every 30 minutes. They look for signs of life. But at the Blackfeet jail, they broke the rules that day. Pepien's body wasn't discovered until nearly 3 hours after he died. We reached out to the BIA, but officials declined to comment. His mom, Wilma Fleury, says she was calling all day to find out when her son was going to get out of jail. She just thought he was in there for being drunk. The guards kept telling her he'd be released once he was sober, but then, that night, a sheriff's deputy showed up at her door.
He goes, "What's Willie to you?" And I thought right away that maybe something happened to him and they're taking him to the hospital or something. I go, "He's my son, why?" And he goes, "I'm sorry to tell you, but he passed away." I go, I said, "I've been calling all day to see if when he was going to get out. That's my boy, that's my youngest kid."
Pepien died on Mother's Day. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Funding for this series provided in part by the Pulitzer Center and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Part two of the series is coming up later in this hour. Following the United States' withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Department of Defense is preparing to house thousands of Afghan refugees on American military installations, including El Paso's Fort Bliss. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports.
Thousands of Afghans who risked their lives helping U.S. forces are now fleeing from Afghanistan as the Taliban tightens its grip on the country. Some who managed to get to the U.S. on special immigrant visas may end up in Texas. Gary Reed of the Defense Department spoke to reporters at the Pentagon Monday.
As we prepare for even more arrivals, U.S. NORTHCOM and the U.S. Army are working to create additional capacity to support refugee relocation in the U.S., including temporary sites under assessment at Fort Bliss, Texas, and Camp McCoy, Wisconsin.
Those facilities will provide food and medical care for the refugees during processing. The Pentagon's working with the State Department to find other processing locations for Afghan refugees who don't qualify for special immigrant visa status. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
President Biden has taken a lot of criticism about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, but others say there are real limits to what can be accomplished with military security, including commentator Walt Rubel.
This week, the United States joined a long list of nations that have tried and failed to rule Afghanistan. The fact that our 20-year effort in Afghanistan was no more successful than all the great empires before us should not be surprising. What is surprising is how quickly all of our efforts have come undone, and how little we were able to accomplish in 2 decades of work and sacrifice seeking to install a credible government and competent military. Leaders have been telling us for the past 20 years that our commitment in Afghanistan was temporary. We would only be there for as long as it takes to build a self-sustaining government. It's now become obvious that day will never come. It won't matter if we stay another 20 years or another 200 years. This week, the war has come to an inglorious conclusion. The Afghan army that we've been equipping and training for 20 years failed to stop the advance of the Taliban as it claimed one town after another on its march to Kabul. Scenes of desperate Afghans clinging to American military airplanes attempting to leave the country bring back bad images from Saigon in March 1973, when our nation was ending another unsuccessful military campaign. President Joe Biden can be faulted for a lack of planning in the war's final days. But, as with Vietnam, our discomfort with how the war ended does not alter the fact that both wars needed to end much sooner than they did. As we approach the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, I fear that many of our nation's leaders have learned the wrong lessons from our failed attempts at nation building in Afghanistan and Iraq. They believe we left Iraq too soon, leading to the rise of ISIS. And they believe we're leaving Afghanistan too soon, leading to a resurgence of the Taliban. The real lessons are the limitations as to what can be accomplished with a strong military. Some members of Congress seem to be learning that lesson. In June, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 268 to 161 to repeal the authorization for use of military force, which was passed immediately after the 9/11 attacks and has been used like a blank check by three different presidents to justify any military actions they wanted to take. The bill still needs to be passed by the Senate. Our nation is a much different place now than it was 20 years ago. While foreign terrorists are still a threat, the greater threat is now posed by Americans lashing out at their fellow countrymen over any number of perceived grievances. It's time we stopped fighting yesterday's wars and turned our attention to the home front. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. To Environmental News Now, and a project mapping the locations of fences is helping wildlife as they migrate. The New Mexico News Connection's Eric Tegedoff reports.
In some rural areas, fences outnumber roads, but they're much harder to pinpoint and map. Simon Bizard with the National Wildlife Federation is leading an effort to find fences and overlay that information with movement data for pronghorns in southwest Montana. He says the project is prioritizing fences that can directly hamper the species' migration patterns and can find trouble spots.
Where we see a stark line where all of a sudden all the animals move at a 90-degree angle and we see there's a fence there, we go out on the ground and take stock of what type of fence it is. Is the landowner interested in discussing opportunities for modification? Is it on public land?
He says identifying fences on the landscape that can be more wildlife friendly is important, not only for pronghorn, but other species, elk, mule deer, moose, as well as ground nesting birds like sage grouse. The New Mexico Department of Game and Fish estimated there were as many as 45,000 pronghorn in the state in 2015. For New Mexico News Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A big change is coming to Las Cruces next year. The use of plastic bags at retailers will be limited following a unanimous vote this week by the city council. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Restrictions on single-use plastic bags will go into effect on January 1st, 2022, due to the passage of a Las Cruces ordinance aimed at reducing plastic pollution. Councillor Tessa Beda-Stuvi says that while it'll take time for the public to adjust to the ordinance, the change will bring significant community impact.
Honestly, I see this as an investment for the future, and it helps protect everything from our quality of life to our climate. There is an adjustment that will have to happen to people, but in a few years, I think it will become more normal.
Establishments such as grocery stores, gas stations, and department stores are included in the ordinance, though food banks and restaurants will be exempt from restrictions. Restricted businesses seeking to provide paper bags to customers as an alternative will now be required to charge a 10-cent fee. According to Las Cruces Sustainability Officer Lisa LaRocque, in a survey of 1,600 city residents, more than 76% agreed or strongly agreed that encouraging reusable bags protects the environment. In that same city survey, 84% of residents indicated they reuse plastic bags for household needs, like trash liners. Some experts, such as University of Sydney economist Rebecca Taylor, say restricting use causes its own environmental challenges, telling NPR in 2019 that in the California region she studied, 4-gallon garbage bag purchases rose 120% after a local plastic bag ban was enacted. But LaRocque says that the throwaway mentality associated with plastic bags must be stopped to preserve both the environment and resident health.
Most plastics are petroleum-based and are not designed to biodegrade. And plastics can last in the environment for hundreds of years where they break down into small microbeads. And these microbeads are prone to have toxins attached to them, and they can be passed through and accumulate in the food chain.
She says that unlike the city of Albuquerque's plastic bag restrictions, Las Cruces is restricting all plastic bags rather than specifying bag thickness.
We learned from Albuquerque that retailers had just offered a little bit thicker bag and made themselves exempt from this ordinance. And as our goal is to reduce plastic waste and the damaging consequences of microplastics, we opted to cut plastic use entirely.
LaRocque says that one household uses approximately 1,500 plastic bags a year, often for an average of fewer than 12 minutes.
The high turnover rate is something Councillor Gabe Vasquez takes notice of, saying that this ordinance can help create a cleaner city image for residents and visitors alike.
Seeing those mesquite trees and other bushes lined with just hundreds of plastic bags is painful and makes me cringe that's the image that we are putting forth of our city when people come to visit or for our residents. We get endless complaints from residents in different parts of the city in which plastic is the major source of pollution. And when those bags make it out to the desert, to harder to reach area, they're going to stay there for hundreds of years.
Councillor Ioana Bencomo wants to see more plastic bag restrictions enacted across the country, saying she hopes to see local governments provoke action on the federal level.
This is about making our community cleaner and healthier for us, but I also think it's about being part of a growing momentum and a growing movement in this country of cities opting into policies like this that puts pressure and makes demands on Congress. Ultimately, they are the ones that must act with national policy to ensure that our future looks a little bit cleaner.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
KRWG News This Week, I'm Fred Martino. We continue our investigation of tribal jails now. Nate Hedgie is in Shiprock, New Mexico for part two of our series.
Carlos Yazzie's brother, Chris, is standing on land his family has owned for generations. It's beautiful red rock desert in the northern part of the Navajo Nation. But for Chris, it carries a lot of bad memories.
We always grew up with a lot of shame, you know, a lot of guilt, a lot of heartache because my stepdad, you know, he was just kind of a heartless man, you know, he only thought of himself.
He says his stepdad was an alcoholic Marine veteran who used to beat his kids.
He would just take his knuckle and just get you right on the head, man, and you'd just be, you know, you'd be in pain for about 10, 15 minutes, man, and he did stuff like that because, you know, you couldn't see the bumps on your head, man, you know.
Chris says that relentless abuse drove many of his siblings towards drugs and alcohol, including Carlos, his older brother. Carlos was a big guy in his mid-40s with a dark complexion.
You know, straight hair, he kind of had a little mullet going on.
He was a hard worker with a talent for masonry. That is, when he wasn't drinking.
A lot of times he acknowledged, you know, hey, I'm a drunk, yeah, I'm addicted to alcohol.
That addiction put Carlos in and out of jails his entire life, including the night of his death. But on that final night, he arrived desperately needing medical attention. His right foot was swollen and his blood alcohol content was estimated to be 0.461. That's 6 times the legal limit. Ian Paul is a forensic pathologist for New Mexico's Office of the Medical Investigator. He says anything over 0.3 is considered potentially lethal.
The vast majority of people couldn't function at all and in fact would be comatose at a concentration of 0.461.
Jail records show that authorities knew Yazzie was intoxicated and argumentative, but they decided he was healthy enough to stay in the jail. He was put in a cramped isolation cell. They were supposed to check on him every 30 minutes. That's federal policy. But he was left unmonitored for 6 hours. A guard found his body in the morning as he was handing out orange jumpsuits. An autopsy report that was supervised by Paul found that Carlos died from acute alcohol poisoning, a condition that's easily treatable at a hospital.
The standard treatment would be a tube placed into the trachea to help his breathing, intubation, and place him on a breathing machine for a few hours until his blood alcohol concentration would have decreased.
Back at his house on the Navajo Nation, Chris Yazzie says, sure, his brother was a severe alcoholic. But maybe that night would have been a turning point for him.
The corrections officers are basically, you know, are holding these lives in their hands with their decisions, you know.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Navajo Department of Corrections declined to comment on Yazzie's case, but jail records show that both of the guards on duty had not completed the basic required training at the Indian Police Academy to do their jobs. This training includes 400 classroom hours of CPR, first aid, and how to deal with intoxicated inmates. Federal investigators and correctional officers say the Indian Police Academy has a chronic backlog. Ophelia Begay is the supervisor at a jail in nearby Window Rock, Arizona.
You know, when you first come aboard, you are required to be certified, become certified within 1 year, but that does not happen.
For example, she's been pushing 2 years to get one of her female guards certified.
I cannot leave her alone. She has to have someone all the time with her.
That's because under federal policy, an untrained guard shouldn't be left alone. But sometimes staff shortages mean that happens, as it did during the final hours of Yazzie's life. And a lack of training isn't the only problem at many of these facilities. There are also no doctors or nurses on staff. And that had deadly results for both Yazzie and a 33-year-old mother of four named Brandy Skunkcap. Her story is next in our series. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Native American boarding schools have been in the news after forensic technology revealed thousands of previously unknown graves of Native American children throughout the U.S. and Canada. In focus today, a segment of KUNM's Let's Talk New Mexico, Ty Bannerman speaks with Dr. John Graham, author of Education at the Edge of Empire, Negotiating Pueblo Identity in New Mexico's Indian Boarding Schools.
Around the end of the 19th century, the federal government makes a decision to basically take over the bulk of Indian education for itself. It had been supporting religious organizations doing this job for them, but begins to take over the process for itself. And part of this process is it builds a couple of dozen off-reservation boarding schools that sit at the top of this system of hundreds of government schools that feed into them. And two of those off-reservation boarding schools are built in Santa Fe and in Albuquerque. And I think it's really important to acknowledge what I think Glenn, one of the callers, said earlier. He used the word genocide. I think we need to be comfortable using that word in relation to these schools. The purpose of these schools was to destroy indigeneity. One of the really important leaders in the boarding school movement, Richard Pratt, actually, his phrase is kill the Indian, save the man.
Right.
So you have this sense in which white Americans have become convinced through their scientific knowledge at the time that indigenous peoples cannot survive. They have to be saved from themselves. And that is actually the purpose of these schools. It is genocidal to destroy Indianness, not only for the sake of saving Indians from themselves, but also, quite frankly, to have better access to indigenous lands and to destroy indigenous political power. So that's sort of what the purpose of the schools that they opened in the late 19th century. And that really, that purpose doesn't really get challenged, honestly, until around 1928, when the government releases something called the Merriam Report. And in light of the Merriam Report, reformers begin to sort of think through what are these schools supposed to accomplish? Is there inherent value in indigeneity? And I don't want to give too rosy a picture because the reform movements themselves are still very ethnocentric. They certainly are still have the purpose of trying to assimilate Native youth into the American culture. They're not trying to preserve indigenous language and culture. But in some ways, post-World War II is sort of a different story. When it comes to how severe the assimilative model is, but it's still there, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why so many indigenous tribal nations have begun to have their own efforts at education, building their own schools, at times taking over these boarding schools, because ultimately, even if the model is less severe, there still was not a model predicated on preservation,
right,
of tribal traditions and language and culture.
And here in New Mexico, I understand that there was kind of a different evolution over time than we saw at places like the Carlisle Industrial Boarding School and that sort of thing. Is that right?
Yes. And one of the things I argue in my book is that there are several sort of local realities that make the experience at Santa Fe and Albuquerque Indian School somewhat different for Pueblo students than it might have been for students at these other schools, which isn't to downplay either the intentions of the schools or downplay the severity of the experiences that could be had there. But at the same time, there are several local factors that I think allow Pueblo communities and Pueblo students to push back and to challenge the power of these schools in ways that maybe other tribal nations don't get those opportunities. One is, for a very long time, there's sort of this ambiguous legal status that Pueblos enjoy. Mexico, when it still controlled what we call the Southwest now, it had just kind of artificially declared the Pueblos to be citizens. They were Mexican citizens now. They weren't seen as indigenous legally anymore. And so when the U.S. Conquers and steals the Southwest, the treaty that ends that war says that all Mexican citizens should have the opportunity to become American citizens, and their land rights should be respected. And so legally, this creates a problem, because from the U.S. perspective, from federal law's perspective, all indigenous peoples are considered wards of the state during this late 19th century period. But the Pueblos are also Mexican citizens. So are they indigenous? Are they citizens? So this ambiguity gives them some wiggle room that I think helps quite a bit. You also have the fact that the Pueblos, that by the time they encounter the schools, the Pueblos already have generations of experience with colonial powers. This is not their first time to experience an invasion by outsiders mm-hmm. trying to destroy their way of life. You also have the fact that in New Mexico you have a strong Catholic presence, not only through the churches but through the schools, and these Catholic schools and priests actually become a competition, actually become a challenge to the federal power, and that gives the Pueblos opportunities to kind of play both sides off each other in some ways that maybe other tribal nations don't have that opportunity. So again, none of that is to downplay what the schools wanted to accomplish, mm-hmm. Nor is it to downplay the very destructive nature of what they were able to accomplish, but it is to say that I think the other part of that story is making sure we're giving credit, not only in this story to the Pueblo nations, but giving credit to other students and other tribal communities, that one of the reasons, maybe the main reason the schools fail, is because indigenous people do push back. They do fight for their children. They do everything in their power to oppose this, mm-hmm. Even when that power is limited. And that should be part of the story, too.
That was Dr. John Graham. He is the author of Education at the Edge of Empire, Negotiating Pueblo Identity in New Mexico's Indian Boarding Schools. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. To the arts now, and Nancy Griffith wrote songs about small-town Texas life. The Grammy-winning singer-songwriter passed away last week at the age of 68. Her tunes became hits, but not for herself. As the Texas Standard's Shelley Brisbane reports, Griffith combined a delicate, winsome stage presence with a fierce dedication to songwriting.
Oh, I wish it would rain and wash my face clean. I want to find some dark clouds.
Nancy Griffith adored words. Several album covers show her posing with books. Her Grammy award-winning homage to the songwriters she admired, Other Voices, Other Rooms, was named for a Truman Capote novel. When Griffith spoke and sang in her own voice, she mourned lost love and made keen observations about the Texas she grew up in. And as her world expanded, her writing chronicled some of the hard lives lived by those she encountered. Stephen Doster was one of her earliest collaborators.
I came to Austin about 75 and started playing at the Hole in the Wall on the drag, and Nancy Griffith was playing there as well.
Griffith held her own at the Austin Dive Bar.
She was a suffer no fools when she could play at the Hole in the Wall. In fact, it was a pretty well-known thing that she was going to be telling the crowd to shut up.
Doster played guitar on Griffith's first album in 1978 and joined her in Nashville for her third, Once in a Very Blue Moon, 6 years later. By then, Griffith had a record deal with folk label Rounder and a lot of friends and musical collaborators she could call on. Her acoustic sound had been amped up a notch with stalwart Nashville players like Bela Fleck, Roy Husky Jr., and Mark O'Connor, and a lanky guy she knew from the Texas music scene named Lyle Lovett singing harmony.
Of course, after that, things really took off for her even more so. I would like to think the Once in a Very Blue Moon record and her first Austin City Limits performance was a big jump for her.
Beginning in 1985, Griffith performed on the PBS show Austin City Limits 8 times. Griffith didn't write the title song from Once in a Very Blue Moon, but she made the Pat Alger tune her own. So much so that the band she traveled with starting in the late 80s was called the Blue Moon Orchestra. It happened again with From a Distance, the Julie Gold-written song that Griffith was first to record. Nancy's version inspired Bette Midler to record it too, spawning a giant hit. Many consider Griffith's 1986 album Last of the True Believers her masterpiece. It contains the iconic Love at the Five and Dime. It tells the story of a Woolworths cashier who falls in love with a musician and their life together. The song would go on to be a breakthrough hit for Kathy Mattea.
Rita was 16 years of hazel eyes and chestnut hair. She made the Woolworths counter shine.
Griffith left Austin permanently in 1985 and headed to Nashville, where she signed with MCA Records. Doster says Griffith always had success on her mind.
What most impressed me about her was her work ethic and her drive. We would have a good time at shows and stuff, but she was very serious-minded about what she was doing.
She worked with producer Tony Brown on her next few albums, and that connection would give Griffith a chance to help another Texas artist. Kelly Willis was just starting out when Griffith caught her show at the Continental Club in Austin around 1989.
She got on the phone. She had to go get on the payphone because nobody had phones back then in the club, and called up Tony Brown, her producer, and said, Tony, you need to get down here. I think you'd like this girl.
They only met that one time, but Willis says Griffith changed her life.
That definitely played a huge role in my eventually signing to MCA and getting to make music with Tony Brown.
For Mary Gaucher, Griffith's generosity took physical form sometime in the early 90s. At a Nashville party, Gaucher and Griffith were part of a group of writers swapping songs. Gaucher had just moved to Nashville to try her hand at music.
I was handed her guitar and asked to play a song in a song circle. When she handed it to me, I did play. And then when I was done, I handed it back and she said, I don't think so. I want you to keep it. And she gave me that Taylor, that sunburst cutaway Taylor that you see in all those pictures.
The guitar had once belonged to Harlan Howard, a songwriter hero of Griffith's who had given it to her. For Willis, Gaucher, and other women trying to make a go of it in the music business, Griffith was an inspiration.
She was a trailblazer for women. And her hero, her role model was Loretta Lynn. She loved Loretta because Loretta wrote her own songs.
Terry Hendricks first heard Nancy Griffith on Live at Anderson Fair, a 1988 album recorded at the legendary Houston Club.
My guitar teacher wanted me to hear it because she was a great guitar player. And what also inspired me, though, was her lyrics and was that record, that live record, Live at Anderson Fair.
Over the years, Griffith's sound evolved. She collaborated with Hootie and the Blowfish and Irish group The Chieftains. She became a huge star in Ireland, and spending time there led her to write It's a Hard Life, a song about the Troubles, the 30-year conflict in Northern Ireland, and prejudice in America.
It's a hard life, it's a hard life, it's a very hard life, it's a hard life wherever you go.
Not everyone was taken with Nancy Griffith. Some critics complained that her singing and her stage patter were affected and sometimes too precious. Hendricks believed Griffith made artistic choices to sound the way she did, sometimes emphasizing the childlike quality of her characters and sometimes embodying them at a deep level.
As an artist, there's this parallel between light and dark, and I think she danced on that razor's edge, and I think part of that little girl voice was part of that deep little girl inside of her.
Nancy Griffith survived two bouts with cancer in her 40s and returned to performing. But in the past decade, she had receded from the music scene. She released her last album, Intersection, in 2012. There's a tribute record in the works, delayed by the pandemic but due in 2022. Mary Gaucher has recorded a song for it. For her fans and fellow artists, Nancy Griffith's legacy is secure as a gifted songwriter.
She was just a good, good, good songwriter. And she captured the time that she lived in, which is, I think, the greatest thing any songwriter could do.
For the Texas Standard, I'm Shelley Brisbane.
God bless the flyer. You would be flying on the night. La, 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 la. 'Cause I would give anything. See that flyer flying tonight. Be flying home.
Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us on KRWG News this week. To education news now, and a new pilot program is teaching college students about the agriculture industry. More from Roz Brown at the Texas News Service.
Casey LaPointe knew her favorite childhood moments were spent on a farm, and she's leveraging that insight to lead one of the first chapters of the Collegiate Farm Bureau at West Texas A&M University. A Colorado native, LaPointe visited a farm owned by her extended family as a child. She's now studying animal science and agriculture, business and economics, and attending conferences to learn as much as possible.
I got to talk to peanut farmers, rice farmers, you know, these commodities we don't grow in Colorado. So hearing it from those different producers and getting their perspective is really neat.
In addition to Texas A&M in the Panhandle, Sam Houston State University in Huntsville has launched a Collegiate Farm Bureau with Midwestern State University, Tarleton State University, and Vernon College also planning to launch chapters. Whit Weems with the Texas Farm Bureau says the program is valuable because college students can network with others who like the idea of farming or finding an ag-related job that fits their skills.
You don't have to be an ag major to be in the Collegiate Farm Bureau program. There's opportunities in agriculture beyond just the farm. There's so many different sectors to agriculture and supporting roles.
LaPointe says it still surprises her when people her age don't know where their food comes from.
I had a classmate in middle school who says, "Wait, raisins and grapes are the same thing? I thought raisins were their own plant." And people who think pickles and cucumbers are two different things.
As older producers on farms and ranches retire, the USDA says only about 2% of Americans now work in the agriculture industry, and the average age of an American farmer is about 57. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Construction is underway on a new animal services center right next to the current facility. It's part of the Las Cruces Go Bond project, with final completion set for the fall of next year. Emily Guerra spoke to Animal Services Center Executive Director Clint Thacker about the importance of these services.
What services are offered to the community, both to people and the animals?
The Animal Service Center in Mesilla Valley is the only open admission shelter in all of Doñana County. So we have a lot of animals coming through here. In 2019, we had over 10,000 animals come through the center, and that's just animals from animal control bringing in a stray. We have people bringing in animals that are found, and then owned animals that are being relinquished by their owners. It's a big production. When fully staffed, we have around 60 employees, and we are always finding ways to do better at our jobs here at the center. So that's what I like about us.
What ongoing challenges does the center have?
We have several ongoing challenges. I think the biggest one right now is just the flood of animals that are coming into the center. We are constantly seeing litters and litters and litters of cats and dogs being brought in. We are always sharing the message that we have to spay and neuter. Please spay and neuter. We have those services available to the public through SNAP. They're a program here locally in Doñana County in the city of Las Cruces. So overpopulation is a big issue here, especially for the center. And it boils down to everybody. It goes down to the employees because it's stress on them caring for them. And unfortunately, for sometimes we have to euthanize some of those animals. And so that's always a stress as well. There is another issue that we have, and that is currently staffing. It is so hard right now to find individuals that are willing to do this work. And then keep them. So that's something we're working on, always hiring. If anybody's ever interested, go to the City of Las Cruces website. We're not part of the city, but they handle our hiring for us, and you'll find the job descriptions there.
And what about during the pandemic? It's still ongoing. What challenges did you have then?
You know, the pandemic was bad on many cases, but for the animal industry and specifically for us, it was really a really good thing for the animal-wise. What I mean by that is we limited all intake. We limited intake from animal control and from the people coming in. In 2020, we only had 6,500 animals come in the center in all of 2020. When you compare that to the over 10,000 that comes in usually, it's a big decrease. So what does that mean for staff? It was less animals had to care for. We had a better morale with the staff. We were able to do things that we've never done before. With the staff and with the animals. So COVID did present some challenges. Of course, we had to change the wait, you know, outside. You had to make an appointment instead of just walking through the doors. We had to limit the amount of people coming into the facility. So there were challenges, but there were also some benefits from it as well.
Going back to the pandemic, a lot of people were at home. They were working from the house. They were able to take care of a dog. And now many people are going back to work. What has happened with those pets?
You know, across the U.S., there have been issues of people returning those animals back to the centers, but we have not seen that here in Las Cruces. People are retaining the pets they had when they adopted. We did see some of the fosters that, you know, I'm not working right now, I can foster an animal. We saw some of those come back, but nowhere near the numbers of adoptions returned as other places in the United States. I think it's important for people to remember that there are some really good things that came from the pandemic as far as the animal industry. And one of those is we are asking individuals to please, if you find an animal, to do the responsible thing and try to find the owners for that animal. Like I said, go for a walk. See if you can find it. Place the signs up for found animal. Put a sign up in your yard, because people go out looking for their dogs too. Another one is if you own an animal and you want to get rid of it, want to surrender it to us, we are going to ask you to first find an owner yourself. Contact the other local rescues. You know, your answer isn't always bring it to the center. Let's make that your very last resort.
What's something else that people should avoid doing?
Some people will take an animal where they don't want and they will throw it out their car. It's called dumping, dump an animal into an empty street or an empty lot. And that is horrible for the animal because they're not familiar with where they are. They don't have any food, water, shelter, the base necessities that an animal needs. They're a stranger, and that's terrifying. You can imagine if that was done to you, how scared you would be. And animals are no different when it comes to that. So please be responsible. We'll always take an animal if it's the last resort. We always take an animal, whether you found it or if you are the owner and you need to give it to us.
Find the full interview with Clint Thacker on our Puentes page. It's under the news tab at krwg.org. Business news now, and it's been a tough couple of years for many businesses. A pandemic, then a labor shortage. But imagine running a business while you're going to college. It may not be easy, but it can be done. One New Mexico State University student is an inspirational example. She talked with Madison Staten.
Emily Garcia knows a thing or two about making lemonade out of lemons. At 16, she started a specialty lemonade business, Francie Emilade, in order to help establish financial independence. Now a sophomore at New Mexico State University studying civil engineering technology, Garcia is funding her education with revenue generated from her business.
It was something I had to do to financially stay stable for myself to be able to support, since I am a first-year college student within my family. And so doing that really gave me the push and motivation to be like, look, if I want to get this started and going, I got to do it myself.
Establishing her business has not been without hurdles. Garcia says she's had to fight to be taken seriously.
It requires a lot, especially not only being a woman, but also being a younger woman. A lot of people, you know, at my age, 20 years old, don't own a business. And so it definitely was harder to get people to see that I'm really serious.
Those challenges haven't stopped Garcia. She expanded her business this spring with the introduction of the Francie Emilade trailer, which can be seen around Las Cruces or at select festivals and special events. Already, Garcia has taken the trailer to the La Luz Cherry Festival and has plans to work the Hatch Chili Festival over Labor Day weekend.
It's really been an extremely exponential growth. When I first started, you know, I was doing maybe one or two events the entire year, and it was just a really cool thing to see how much it has grown. I never thought it would.
Francie Emilade is just one example of business success in the wake of the pandemic. A 2021 Small Business Owner report by Bank of America finds that 60% of small business owners are forecasting for revenue increases. The impact small businesses have on the national economy is significant. The over 30 million small businesses across the nation make up 99.9% of all businesses within the United States and create two-thirds of net new jobs. But for Garcia, her business is more than just a number. It's a testament to hours of labor and brainstorming, offering her both greater financial freedom and an opportunity to strengthen familial bonds. Garcia says her business is not just about selling a product. It's about the family that has supported and fostered her dream.
having my father be the one who built the trailer and my mom helping with all the behind the scenes stuff and my friends, the community. It's definitely, I think, the thing that makes it most unique more than just lemonade is that it's family.
That family focus is evident even in the name of her business, a tribute to her late grandmother, Frances Moen, who helped to encourage Garcia's entrepreneurial spirit. It's a spirit Garcia hopes to see cultivated more in the youth of Las Cruces, encouraging young potential business owners to pursue their dreams early.
I really love seeing other people pursue a business. I just think it's such a great thing in today's day and age. It's hard to find a job that's going to be willing to pay you enough and willing to be fulfilling and give you enough prosperity and success in your future. But if you're able to have that within yourself to pursue a business and make it your own and sell your own product instead of someone else's, it just gives you such a huge amount of gratitude and satisfaction knowing that you did this and it wasn't through someone else.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Recapping our top story this week, a reminder that masks are required once again indoors in the state of New Mexico. And finally this week, it is easy, of course, to find advice regarding COVID-19 vaccinations for children right now. But here's another issue you may not have considered. Many kids returning to school could be missing other vaccinations for diseases like chickenpox, measles, or polio. Roz Brown has more from the Texas News Service.
As of May, orders for non-influenza childhood vaccines decreased by a total of 11.7 million doses compared with 2019, according to a report from the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families and American Academy of Pediatrics. Seth Kaplan with the Texas Pediatric Society says routine vaccinations help prevent outbreaks of contagious diseases, such as measles or chickenpox, and notes well-child visits are needed to check on growth and development.
It's not just about vaccines. It's about their whole health care and preparation for sports and readiness for school and keeping people on their regular well-child schedule.
Kaplan notes that if too few people in a community are vaccinated against a particular disease, an outbreak could develop. Texas law requires that students be fully vaccinated against specific diseases. Dr. Lee Beers with the American Academy of Pediatrics says it's important that parents avoid misinformation that could remove their power to make a good decision for their kids.
There's all sorts of reasons that a family may have not been able to make it in for their well visit, and we understand that, and we understand that it's been a hard year, but we also really want to make sure that your child is healthy and safe and well protected.
Kaplan also would like to see more Texas kids who are 12 and older coming in for their COVID vaccinations.
Here in Texas, if you haven't started already, you're not going to have full protection on board when school starts. But now's the time, and then we eagerly await word from the FDA and the CDC on younger kids.
The Food and Drug Administration has said COVID-19 vaccines for children younger than 12 could come in early to midwinter. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Stay up to date with the latest news anytime at the region's homepage, krwg.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG, Las Cruces, and KRXG, Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.